Dan Healy, our guest today, is Professor of History at the University of Reading in England. His book, Bolshevik Sexual Forensics, explores the history of Russian and Soviet forensic medicine. Early Bolsheviks gave forensic doctors, most of whom had trained under the Tsarist regime, new authority in the regulation of sexuality. In an attempt to modernize Russian sexual relations, lawmakers defined new ways of seeing sexual crime and disorder in the Bolshevik state. They reformed legislation that dealt with sexual crime and violence and drew on physicians and psychiatrists as the new scientific experts to describe and diagnose sexual disorder and draw the line between criminal and legal behavior. Healy compares sex crime investigations from Petrograd and Sverdlovsk in the 1920s to the numerous publications by forensic doctors and psychiatrists of the pre-revolutionary and early Soviet periods. Although revolutionaries had a vision that the new Russia would be a place in which men and women were equals, Soviet medicine's emphasis on biology and physiology left no room for ideas of sexual self-expression, and law and medicine failed to protect women and girls from sexual violence. Listen as Dan Healy tells us about his new book, Bolshevik Sexual Forensics, Diagnosing Disorder in the Clinic and Courtroom, 1917 to 1939, published by Northern Illinois University Press in 2009. Good morning. Welcome, Dan. It's a pleasure to talk to you this morning. I wonder, and we'll be talking about your book, Bolshevik Sexual Forensics, Diagnosing Disorder in the Clinic and Courtroom between 1917 and 1939, which came out with Northern Illinois University Press in 2009. And I have to say, I am a big fan of your first book. I make all of my graduate students read it. And whenever they falter, I tell them that they should go and read your introduction and they should read it over and over again. So I'm really excited about having this conversation about the next book. And I wonder whether you can start by telling us this very intriguing story in your acknowledgement that kind of talks about how you got to the topic in the first place.
Well, this story of my visit to the Saratov School of Forensic Medicine within Saratov University, Saratov State University, took place actually after I began this project, and I took the train 16 hours to Saratov from Moscow. It's a long way, and turned up at the School of Forensic Medicine and said I was writing a history of aspects of forensic medicine in the early Soviet period, and I'd been inspired by some of the protagonists in Soviet forensic medicine who came from that school. And so they were very excited by that, and they invited me in to the institute and gave me the run of their library and introduced me to their students and so forth. But every Wednesday when I would go in, I would be confronted by a very strange scene. There would be a group of students clustered around the center of this central hall, which had a kind of museum display cases and so forth. But on the floor, in the middle of these students, would be a corpse.
On the floor. That's really funny.
I wanted to say a real live corpse, but of course, far from. And the students would have, the instructors would have placed other props around the corpse, and the students would effectively be coming cold to a mocked up crime scene or scene of an unexplained death, and they would have to begin to work through the logic of how you explain a death from material signs mm-hmm. on the body and clues around the body. I mean, they had such things as empty vodka bottles, fake plastic vomit, and that sort of thing placed around the body. I shudder to imagine what the loved ones of these particular corpses might have thought had they had the opportunity to see this. But
right.
There you are. The corpses came from mortuary downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
The city mortuary happened to be located in the same building as the Forensic Institute. This is often where you find mortuaries in former Soviet cities.
Yeah.
And so there was, if you like, a steady supply of corpses for every Wednesday scenario. So I got used to seeing them.
Did they have corpses of both genders, or was it always men?
It seemed to be men, mostly.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know whether that was a decision about dignity or whether that was a decision about that reflected the very high death rate among middle-aged and older men.
Yeah.
In Russia at the time. This is going back to 2000 when I was in Saratov.
Yeah.
So, and interestingly enough, too, during the time I was in that institute, we had a steady parade of living subjects coming through the institute who were being examined because of their claims for welfare benefits based on the fact that they were World War II veterans.
Interesting.
So their wounds were being examined, scars and that sort of thing, and their claims were being reviewed by the institute staff.
Yeah. So what led you from the topic of homosexual desire in revolutionary Russia to the forensic issues?
Well, essentially, I worked, when I was writing my book about homosexuality in Tsarist and Soviet Russia, I began in the early 1990s wondering, well, what sort of sources can I use? And after scouting about, I realized that principally my sources were going to be either legal or medical.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, when I got to Russia and began doing my archival research for the project, and this was my first book, my doctoral book,
right.
I found that the legal sources were fragmented. And that the medical sources were often more interesting in certain ways. They had more interesting narratives sometimes, and they were, I hesitate to say sympathetic, but they were more textured, mm-hmm. let's say, like that. So I began to be interested in the intersection between the medical and the legal in Soviet practice, and how that really seemed to structure the way that sexuality was perceived, sexuality was understood in the early Soviet period. And this seemed to me quite different from what we knew about the sexual revolution from declarative texts.
Mm-hmm.
Things like Alexander Kollontai's novels and the decrees of the Soviet government, and
mm-hmm.
And not just the novels of Kollontai, but the novels of a whole swathe of mostly second-rate sort of authors who wrote mm-hmm. about the sexual theme during the 1920s, when discussion of the sexual revolution was at its height. So it was about medicine and law and their interaction. I thought that there was more room for investigation there. And I'd been very captivated, actually, by court records and what one could do with them
mm-hmm.
In the first book. In the case of homosexuality, it was very difficult to find full court records of actual prosecutions of homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
In Moscow city court records, I remember finding not the whole trial record, but just two-page or five-page sentencing documents that summarized the case and gave the sentence that
right.
you got. And those were bound in, they were printed on onion skin kind of duplicate copies and bound in sort of foot-high sort of volumes. And I remember I flipped through 11,000 pages of those.
Wow.
To find 8 cases.
Yes.
with 36 individuals in them.
Yeah.
So that that alerted me to several things. One was that there were plenty of cases of ordinary, of heterosexual rape.
Yeah.
Of the abuse of minors in these same kinds of records.
Yeah.
That I was sifting through a fairish number of those to find my occasional sodomites.
Right.
So I knew that the records existed and it would just be a matter of finding enough of them.
Yeah.
To assemble a kind of picture of heterosexual sexual disorder, if you like.
Yeah.
I noticed, of course, as well that forensic medicine was very important in the operation of those trials.
Mm-hmm.
That they provided a really important part of the evidence for police. That was certainly the case in the trials of homosexuals in the 1930s and 40s and afterwards. And it was already obviously there in the trials for heterosexual offenses.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that there was a kind of existing source base there. And I thought if I could develop an analysis of these sources, then I could begin to say something useful, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
about the way professions help to interpret the sexual revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And in a funny sort of way, after I finished my book about homosexuality, I thought it's time to write a book about heterosexuality.
Right.
But what sort of book would it be?
Yeah.
And in a sense, I knew because there would be trial records, I'd be able to assemble a nice chunky set of trial records around heterosexual offenses. That I would be able to say something different and interesting about actual practices around medicine and perhaps mm-hmm. actual practices around sexuality, rather than raking over the old declarative texts that have been so much part of our discussion of the sexual revolution in Bolshevik Russia up until now.
Yeah. So you open the book by kind of talking about the changes that come to sexual life and ideas about sexuality with the Russian Revolution, which I thought was really interesting. So could you talk a little bit about what those changes are, but also about continuities maybe that came from the Tsarist era?
Well, it's interesting because the desire for change is actually one of those major continuities.
Yeah.
In an interesting sort of way. The revolutionary tradition is actually bedded down as a tradition well before 1917.
Uh-huh.
A whole sort of two or three generations of Russian intelligentsia and Russian political activists thinking about the relationship between the sexes. It's often posed, the problem is often not posed as a sexual problem, but as a problem of gender, as a problem mm-hmm. of the women question. That
mm-hmm.
sort of. And women's equality is the central kind of problem
mm-hmm.
that leads to a discussion of sexuality among the Russian radicals and intellectuals before the revolution. So there's a long continuity already of imagining what future sexuality or future gender relations might be like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even before you get to the last 30 years of the Russian regime, of the Tsarist regime, where there's a quickening of expert ideas about sexuality and gender that's also contributing to the discussion. So it's not just a political discussion about women's equality and about equality within marriage and about access to, they're not really talking about birth control or abortion very much before the late Tsarist regime, the last years of the Tsarist regime, but they're talking about women's sexual autonomy implicit
yeah.
in various ways. They're imagining it
yeah,
and what that might be like already Tolstoy's short story, The Kreutzer Sonata, and in other kinds of literature. That's already being imagined and discussed what that means. But then you have doctors, psychiatrists, criminologists, lawyers contributing to a wider discussion about sexuality and how it should be understood, what its origins are, how it might be regulated more successfully with the help of that kind of medical expertise.
Mm-hmm.
All that's already, in a sense, on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Well before 1914.
And are these experts that you're describing at the moment basically in a larger dialogue with the same kind of emergence of such a discourse in European countries?
Very much so. They're participants in international conferences and congresses,
yeah,
of criminology, of criminal anthropology. They are in the last decade or so of the Tsarist regime, there's a flourishing interest in psychoanalysis,
mm-hmm,
for example, and some of Freud's most important patients are actually wealthy Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Sergei Pankejev, the Wolfman, for example,
mm-hmm,
so one of his most famous patients is a Russian, Spielrein, Sabina Spielrein as well, is
mm-hmm,
another very important patient from Russia, who incidentally goes back to Russia to practice psychoanalysis,
mm-hmm,
in the 1920s. So you have a traffic back and forth between the two metropolitan capitals of Russia, St. Petersburg and Moscow, and the important capitals of where culture and science and medicine are being discussed and developed in Western Europe,
mm-hmm,
at the time. There are a significant number, for example, of psychiatrists who I look at in one chapter of this book, psychiatrists whose training and formation is really in Germany or in Austria before the revolution.
Yeah.
Very many of them don't simply train at home in Russia. They have to go for a period, like an apprenticeship, of training under the great professors in Germany and,
yeah,
and Austria. So there is a transfer of knowledge to Russia, and also a circulation back from Russia to the West.
Yeah, that was my other question. I mean, basically then once we get to the Bolshevik Revolution, now that we've talked about continuities, we can talk about differences. What is specific to the way in which Bolsheviks perceive sexuality and the changes they want to see? And, you know, insofar as we can talk about an emergence of a particular Soviet sexology, what does that imply?
It's very interesting because I think it has, in one sense, it has two sides. One side is declarative, and it's for the outside world. It's to show the world the way forward in sexual regulation and sexual politics, really. And that's a kind of message that I think even today non-specialists who maybe teach the Soviet sexual revolution as part of other courses on the history of gender or the history of science, I think that's the thing that they remember most.
Yeah.
This the radical equality of men and women within marriage is something,
yeah,
that is particular about the Soviet sexual revolution. Neither sex has primacy in in marriage. The radical you might say indifference to the inviolability of marriage that the Soviets bring with their legislation that makes divorce a very simple procedure,
mm-hmm,
and a very cheap procedure.
Mm-hmm.
The shocking in 1920 legalization of medical abortion,
mm-hmm,
and making it free on demand, not to everybody in the country, but to certain insured groups in the country ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
But the legalization of abortion is absolutely shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Vast waves of European opinion. It's one of the reasons why the Spaniards murder feminists during the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, 1936-39. They're aghast at the idea of women controlling their fertility
mm-hmm.
in such a direct way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're aghast at the idea of communists making it possible for medicine to assist in that process. So those are very radical reforms. Another radical reform is, of course, the decriminalization of male homosexuality,
mm-hmm.
which is discussed from 1919 and is finally enacted in 1922.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Western European context, the only other country that... The main country that did this in the 1790s already was France during the revolution when it decriminalized sodomy and a whole range of other offenses that were seen as essentially offenses against religion or religious mm-hmm. scruples rather than significant crimes as far as the state or society was concerned. And between the 1790s and 1917, the only other major European country that had decriminalized male homosexuality was actually Italy
mm-hmm.
during its unification. So that was so it was a major advance, and it was noticed around the world as well.
Mm-hmm.
So these were important aspects of the Soviet sexual revolution that surprised, pleased, shocked, amazed people
mm-hmm.
at the time. And they continue, I think, to inspire
mm-hmm.
in the sense that they were so in advance of what many Western societies could accept
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There are all kinds of qualifications that one can add to this picture, however, and that's, I think, one of the big messages of this book, is that what that looked like from the outside was actually often enacted for slightly different purposes, for domestic purposes on the inside, and also that the sense of liberation that we feel coming from the Soviet sexual revolution, looking at it from our perspective, was not what was intended by the highest policymakers and thinkers
yeah.
At the time.
Yeah.
I think I say somewhere in the book, the end point of the Bolshevik sexual revolution was not the realization of the individual's ability to go out there and realize herself and her individual sexual desire.
Yeah.
A very collectivist view, in fact, of sexuality. And the various changes that were brought in to modernize, to medicalize, and to collectivize sexuality
yeah.
for a collective purpose. So there is, that's an important qualifier that I think the book argues for.
So, and so far as there is an emergence of a specific Soviet sexology after the Bolshevik Revolution, can you talk for a moment about how that stands to this idea of a collective sexuality or to collectivize this yes. issue that you were just raising?
Yes. I think that the if we talk about a Soviet sexology, it's there is no institute of sexology set up by the Bolsheviks after 1917.
Uh-huh.
But there are lots of different places where sexology, as we would recognize it, is being done.
Yeah.
In different institutional homes. So there are criminologists who are investigating the deviant sexuality of the criminal woman, for example.
Yeah.
Sharon Kowalski's book, fantastic book, Deviant Women, looks at that. There are, who else have we got? We have psychiatrists who imagine themselves as being able to counsel the good Soviet worker and his wife around their sexual problems, and who set up clinics and special sort of drop-in centers near places of work where those kinds of issues can be discussed in confidence and in great sympathy, actually. And Francis Bernstein's book, The Dictatorship of Sex, looks at those psychiatrists. So they're practicing a different kind of psychiatry. My sort of penal doctors, the forensic doctors and forensic gynecologists and forensic psychiatrists, work on a kind of sub-branch, if you like, of the criminologists. They're looking for the origins of sexual crime and sexual disorder in the individual. So they are trying to take some of those techniques and teachings from Western sexology and apply them to the cases they have in front of them, but also give them a Marxist gloss.
Yeah.
In some fashion or other. They're also looking to, in a sense, collectivize the individual through what they're saying. So they exist to furnish the state and particularly the courts and the police with expertise around these issues to sort of say, well, this person is a sexual psychopath, but he is responsible for his actions, and you can go ahead and bring him to trial in confidence that he can answer for his crimes. Or they might be saying, in the case of a female victim of rape, for example, yes, this person has been raped, and here are the signs and symbols of that and the indications of that, and there is a case to answer here. Those kinds of issues. So the sexology, in a sense, is very, in the Soviet Union, in this time period, is not a unifying discipline. It's very situational. It's very determined, I think, by the specific institutions that are doing it and the specific audiences or clients that it's actually addressing. My interest was looking at, if you like, clients or audiences or really subjects that are viewed without sympathy, or viewed as somehow as out of the ordinary, as abnormal. And I cast about for a term, because I talk about people like the women victims of rape or children victims of sexual abuse. I talk about sexual psychopaths, and I talk about hermaphrodites. So we have a very mixed picture there. But I arrived at the term sexual disorder to kind of be an umbrella term to encompass all of that.
Let's actually talk about the specifics, aside from the fact that the one thing that I find really interesting here is that the institutionalization of this stops short at a real central research and training institute. But, of course, there are many other problems that Russians are dealing with at that point, so that might be one explanation. But so one of the things that you talk about in the second chapter then is basically the change in the age of sexual maturity. And, you know, it's funny when I thought about that. On the one hand, it's such a liberal idea, but when you think about it, it can also leave young people extremely vulnerable. So how does that play itself out in practice? I mean, how did the Soviet state fare with the switch of an age of consent to one that looks at sexual maturity?
I think it's worth sort of explaining this a little bit more for people who are listening, because they really did get rid of the age of consent as of the new criminal codes of 1922.
And the age of consent was what age before they got rid of
it? Before, it was principally in the Tsarist era, it was 14.
And was it the same for boys as for girls?
Essentially.
Okay.
Essentially. I make some qualifications around that in the chapter.
Yeah.
But essentially you have a clear and reasonably well-known age that people can generally understand. I mean, you have to understand that this is legislation that's meant to discipline populations, right?
Right.
People are supposed to understand its function. So the Soviets get rid of an age of consent for reasons that I'll talk about in a moment, mm-hmm. and they instead enact something called the sexual maturity standard. So a person who's reached sexual maturity can legally consent to consensual sexual activity.
How do they define sexual maturity?
Well, that's the whole story of the chapter.
Okay. I'm sorry.
And I will come to that. But it's a real mystery. And someone who hasn't reached sexual maturity cannot legally consent to sexual activity, and sex with them is a crime.
Yeah.
Under this legislation, and it's a law that remained in effect in Russia until 1996, which is mm-hmm. extraordinary when you think about it, and incidentally in all of the other Soviet republics as well. And now, ex-Soviet republics all change their laws at different times. So we have this sexual maturity standard. What does it mean, and how did they imagine it would work? Well, this was an interesting case that really caught my attention when I first started thinking about this book, because it was so bizarre to me. Why would you do this? And the answer is that around the Soviet Union, first of all, you have numerous different communities and societies. Some people are living in the far north. Some people are living in the south and east in warmer climates. And these scientists and doctors believe that women matured sexually later in the north and earlier in the south. So first of all, they had this perception of a kind of geography of sexual maturity.
Mm-hmm.
And note the gender as well.
Mm-hmm.
Gender, of course, is feminine. And the interest is all in the female body in this
mm-hmm.
sense. So first of all, there's that geography. Secondly, there is a kind of social factor. You have certain societies within the newly forming Soviet Union, particularly Muslim societies, that condone or advance the idea of child marriage or practices mm-hmm. of child marriage or very young marriage. And so, and in fact, this is another long continuity. Russian doctors from the heartland had looked at these societies well before 1917 and had been very displeased by the fact that what they saw was practices of child marriage, which seem to violate the prospects for health for the future mother and future citizen in those communities. So we're talking here about places like Central Asia, like the Transcaucasian republics, particularly Azerbaijan in the south of Russia, of the Russian Empire, and then later the Soviet Union. So the legislators are looking at this great diversity and asking themselves, well, can one age of consent answer all these concerns? It can't. So mm-hmm. We are going to suggest that the concept of sexual maturity should simply be put in the legislation instead of a fixed age of consent. And then in each and every individual case where a complaint is raised or a crime is suspected, the victim will be examined and her or his sexual maturity or lack of it will be established by mm-hmm. a doctor. So this put doctors in the hot seat, really.
Yeah.
in
yeah.
a very interesting way. First of all, when they were... when this idea was being discussed inside the Soviet justice system before the enactment of the criminal code, the proposal was referred to doctors, and the doctors were somewhat horrified by it because they realized that there would be quite a can of worms there, quite
I can imagine. It's not that they necessarily want this responsibility.
No, they don't particularly want this responsibility, and they suspect that it will raise a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And their thinking, their reaction is purely, I mean, I think from the sort of technical expertise side of the equation. No one seems to discuss, beyond talking about how we can change these societies so they don't engage in child sexuality or don't try to exploit child sexuality.
Yeah.
Beyond talking about them in those terms, they never talk about how are we going to communicate this to populations.
Yeah.
And in fact, there never seems to have been an adequate explanation of this law and the sexual maturity standard to the population at large. I have seen no evidence of that whatsoever. Very peculiar. So anyway, the doctors don't want to touch this, but the legislators are very determined to bring in this standard and to get rid of a single age of consent for the entire Russian Federation and then for the Soviet Union a little bit later. And the only reason I can infer, and it is an inference, it's not hard and fast knowledge, that they do this is out of this political problem of how you unite together all of these different social communities within Soviet Russia and how you begin to discipline those communities you want to change.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of central Moscow and Petersburg sort of view of the problem, looking at these other societies that catch up in a sense with European Russia. So how do they imagine sexual maturity? In the earliest textbooks, forensic gynecological textbooks I examine in that chapter, they imagine it as a as purely first menstruation.
That's what I suspected.
Yes, that's the sign. That's the sign and the symbol of sexual maturity.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, they have difficulties if they try to imagine sexual maturity of males. And frankly, they seldom do. But I have a section about that in the chapter as well, where I did find some examples where the sexual maturity of males was queried during certain trials. I mean, trials of young men, very young men, who had been accused of rape or of abuse of young people, and those aren't very revealing, frankly, about the level of thinking going on there. Except to say that when you look at the existing Soviet literature, the sexological literature on the question, it's quite clear that sexual maturity evolved from the early 1920s to the late 1920s into a complex of factors, and as far as women's sexual maturity was concerned, it was always physiological.
So
all the signs were on the body.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting. So women's attitudes, knowledge, feelings about sexuality don't play a role in this at all.
Absolutely none. In fact, anything that smacks of Freudianism, the idea of the desiring woman and her evolving or emerging kind of sense of a sexual identity, anytime anyone voices that at a forensic medical conference or forensic gynecological textbook, bang, shot down. It's not to be. Sexual maturity is a biological is principally a biological problem. If there is a non-biological element to it, it's social. It's given a social gloss. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's what's enshrined later on in 1934 when the definition of sexual maturity really hardens. There's a list of instructions about it that are sent out from the center, from the police, from a committee of police and doctors who work on the problem. And even in the 6 or 7 years before that point, the leading gynecologists are saying it's about specific anthropometric changes in the young woman's body to the point where she can bear a child, successfully carry a pregnancy to term, and give birth to a child, then feed it, and then be able to support it adequately in our society. So it's that last item that really is the social gloss that, in a sense, collectivizes what's just been about this individual body up to now. So that's how the standard evolves.
So can you tell what impact this change had on girls in particular? I mean, here I'm thinking both of, the rape of young girls, but also of incest cases and those kinds of issues.
There are cases like that discussed in the book at some length. I have to say, because this isn't a social history of rape, this isn't a social history of child abuse, I have not explored the impact on the individual victim in great detail. I haven't followed those stories. This is not a cultural history of those kinds of stories. But they're certainly there, and the overwhelming impression I have from reading the large number of cases, crime cases, that the book is based on, is that it was a complete disaster. And, I mean, I think there's an article or even a doctorate to be written about the social history of sexual violence in Russia during this period, because well, there'd be lots of useful reasons for having a social history of sexual violence against women in this period. But I think one of the main ones, perhaps, would be to look at the kind of cultural origins of the thousands of rapes that took place in 1945 in Europe when Soviet soldiers invaded Eastern Europe and occupied Germany and other Eastern European countries. It's well known that there are many thousands of rapes. And I think knowing something about the culture of masculinity and the culture of relations between the genders on the sexual plane would help us there. Having said all of that, I mean, that's not my project in this book. I was looking for how these doctors understood the problems they were dealing with. But it's vastly evident that this was a kind of disaster for Soviet women and girls, because at no time did the government try to explain to the male population sexual maturity. This is what it is, this is how you recognize it, and this is when you may and may not approach a woman for sex. There was none of that kind of clarity. And the forensic doctors argued again and again, at least with an age standard, you have that clarity.
Yeah.
And most legal systems want a degree of clarity as well. So it allows for an awful lot of ambiguity, injustice, I think. I think at some level, Soviet women, I intuit this, I don't know this for sure. At some level, Soviet women must have felt greatly let down by the justice system. I think they probably expected after 1917 that cases of rape would be dealt with in a more enlightened spirit. And certainly many, many more were brought to the courts in the 1920s. But the, in a sense, the biologization of physiological approach to women's sexuality that was brought to the courts by these doctors had the effect of disappointing them, I think.
So do you find that, I found this interesting because it also makes me wonder that whether to the extent that physicians realize that this is not a happy development, whether they try to influence the outcome of these cases by the way in which they themselves approach them and testify about them. And that might lead us, I don't know whether it does, but it might lead us to talk about the way in which they take part in rape cases, for instance.
I think their understanding of what their role was very limited by pre-existing traditions,
mm-hmm.
by the kinds of questions that police and prosecutors asked them,
mm-hmm.
And by their and by their reluctance to engage in language of morality,
yeah.
In their depositions. Their depositions were scrupulously objective in their terms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they refused to moralize.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, the language they used and the inclinations that they showed sometimes obviously point to a moralizing framework. But they mostly talked about signs, and particularly when we're talking about the rape of an adult. The woman's testimony was not something they listened to.
Mm-hmm.
They looked specifically, first of all, for the rupture of the hymen. So they were looking for physical virginity as classically understood. There was no Soviet revision of views about virginity
mm-hmm.
in their view, which is a whole other matter to talk about. And they also looked for signs of a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the classic sort of indicators that they decided were the things that were most relevant in a rape case. And anything else was viewed as too subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And again, going into that psychological realm that the doctors did not wish to probe because they didn't feel it was their disciplinary area to discuss. The psychological realm was for the party to discuss, was for
mm-hmm.
Social organizations and the courts to discuss, but the individual emerging sexual desire was not relevant to the case as far as they were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
So neither was her refusal of consent. The refusal of consent was the basis, obviously, of even Soviet rape legislation. But the doctors felt that was for the prosecutors and the police to demonstrate, and if they could demonstrate it through signs of a struggle on the body of the victim or on the body of the perpetrator, then they felt that they had done enough.
Mm-hmm.
That was the limits of what they were there to provide.
So I don't know if you can answer this, but was it possible, and if so, under what conditions to actually convict somebody of rape?
It is very difficult to answer because I base my study on about 200 cases.
Yeah.
And from two disparate samples, one from Petrograd in the early 1920s and the other from Yekaterinburg in the late 1920s. And there are convictions, and there are even convictions. There are convictions where, for example, the woman had, in the language of the time, not previously lived a sexual life. In other words, she had been a virgin.
She was a virgin, yeah.
And there was clear evidence of recent damage to the hymen. The more difficult cases were the ones where women had been sexually active and then were unable to demonstrate through bruises or injuries on their bodies that they had put up a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, women who could not call on witnesses, women who didn't immediately raise a claim or raise mm-hmm. complaints, those women were really out of luck
mm-hmm.
in the justice system. I speculate on this at the end of the chapter about rape, that it was really very difficult for a woman to, I think, get a conviction
mm-hmm.
on a claim of rape if she was if she had already been living a sexual life, and if there was no evidence of violence and no witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
To have those things brought together in a cluster, you really didn't have the prospect of a successful conviction,
mm-hmm.
tragically.
Mm-hmm.
And even though one of the innovative things about Soviet rape legislation, and this is something that deserves further investigation, frankly, even though in the legislation it said that the violence could be psychological
mm-hmm.
rather than the use of brute physical force, the person could be put under the psychological duress of a perpetrator, and that would still constitute rape. Mm-hmm. And yet, prospects for demonstrating that
mm-hmm.
were lessened because doctors refused to probe the psychology
right.
of the victim. And there was very little listening to the victim, in fact. When you read the, of course, I'm sure the same holds true of American or British criminological manuals for frontline police and investigatory staff
yeah.
in the 1920s and 1930s. When you read the same kind of manuals for the Soviet period where you think there's been a sexual revolution, it makes your hair stand on
end. Yeah.
You know, don't listen to their stories.
Yeah.
Be particularly suspicious if the person has previously lived a sexual life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I quote some of those in the book, and
yeah.
fascinatingly, some of these old saws, which are inheritances from police procedure of the 19th century, some of these old saws are being parroted by women, women forensic doctors. Leah Lightman, in particular, is one I focus on. She's one of the Saratov forensic doctors I highlight in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Did quite a lot of work in forensic gynecology and forensic sexology in the middle of the 1920s in provincial Russia, and even she repeats these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at the clothing they're wearing when they come in. How fancily are they dressed? I mean, the implication,
mm-hmm.
Are they a prostitute?
Mm-hmm.
Are they a woman of, as the Russians call it, light behavior?
Mm-hmm. So how would you then assess the impact that the move of psychiatrists into the courtroom and their participation at trials as expert witnesses had?
Well, I was, I think I was surprised by this. I expected, when I was looking at this question, to find that I knew the psychiatrists had been sort of let into the building by the Bolsheviks in a way that they hadn't been during the Tsarist regime.
During
the Tsarist regime, they were mistrusted by the authorities. Psychiatrists did give testimony. And I talk a little bit about that in the introduction to the chapter, and it was often manipulated and so forth. And but they weren't routinely brought in to investigate sexual crimes. And there was no sort of conception in police procedural manuals and so forth that they were to be part of the routine
yeah.
of this gathering. After they are part of the routine of evidence gathering. And there's a distinct sense that the early Bolsheviks wanted to psychiatrize the criminal,
mm-hmm.
to turn the criminal from a moral and a social, from a moral problem to a social problem, from an individual problem to a collective problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, flows from the Bolshevik view of crime as something that's generated by class conflict, essentially. So the psychiatrists are welcomed into the establishment, if you like, by the Bolsheviks, and it's very striking that the first forensic institutions that the Bolsheviks authorized to be set up are actually forensic psychiatric facilities in Moscow and in Petrograd, Leningrad later, in the very early days of the Bolshevik regime, before the civil war is over, in fact. And and the implication is that a lot of criminals need psychiatric help, not punishment. And so what I expected to find was a certain indulgence of the sex criminal as someone, a person who's mad, not bad, as a person who's sick and perhaps amenable to some form of therapy, than someone who is a criminal who has to be punished. And in fact, what I found was more complicated than that, and not at all like that in effect. The my sample didn't have a large number of cases where psychiatrists were called in. We're really talking about something like 20 cases altogether, where out of 20 out of 200 or 25 out of 200, I can't remember the precise numbers now, of cases where psychiatrists were brought in to offer testimony, either mostly usually about perpetrators, very occasionally about victims, but mostly about perpetrators in cases of sexual crime. And these were a very specific subset of perpetrators. These were people who abused children, in particular. Their abuse of children seemed to require some kind of explanation as far as the authorities were concerned. And so wherever you get a case of the exploitation of children, prepubescent children, there would normally be a psychiatric assessment, at least in the big cities. The beauty of my book, if you like, is that we're comparing a major capital with a big scientific and medical infrastructure, Petrograd, against a provincial city of some substance with its own university and all that other infrastructure, but not very much in the way of a more sophisticated medical infrastructure, including very many psychiatrists. So the style of psychiatry that's practiced in the two samples is very different. But essentially, you get the psychiatrist working on behalf of the police in this small subset of cases of child abusers, and the effect of their examination of these abusers is to confirm that they have what they call sexually psychopathic tendencies or instincts, and that their sexuality is perverse, but at the same time they are answerable for their crimes. It's not such a profound mental illness that they deserve treatment as opposed to punishment. And so they hand the problem back to the police and the authorities to deal with. And it's very interesting that where they use a sexual language to talk about a perpetrator's past, about their desires, about their inclinations, and about their behavior, where they actually describe that in sexual language, they're almost always handing the problem back to the police and the courts to deal with.
In a way, of course, that makes sense because there's nothing psychiatrists can do at that point.
Well, indeed, and I make that point as well, that there is very little that they can do at that point. I mean, even the most advanced and ambitious psychiatrists at the time are turning to people who perform experiments on hormones and on the sex glands in order to make sort of blunt reversals of sexual drive or to suppress sexual drive entirely. You know, at that point, we still have people transplanting testicles and things like that.
Yeah.
From heterosexuals to homosexuals to see if they can suppress homosexual desire.
Yeah.
That's going on in Russia and in Germany and elsewhere. But the idea that psychiatry in and of itself has the ability to cure someone is simply, you know, they realize that they can't do that.
Do you think that the police and the court had hoped differently, or do you think that psychiatrists perform exactly the role that they want them to perform? Maybe this is a question you can't answer. I'm sorry.
It's an interesting question. I think that there was at the highest theoretical level of thinking in the minds of some Bolshevik legislators, and I'm thinking about people like Lenin and worked in the Commissariat of Justice, drafting codes and procedures around these issues. I think that there was an expectation that psychiatry might be able to deliver the expertise.
Yeah.
If not to, at least to diagnose, and hopefully one day to correct and cure.
Sure. Yeah.
There's it's very interesting that in the earliest days of the Bolshevik regime, there's an openness to Freudian psychiatry that shuts down very rapidly at the end of the 1920s. And that openness to Freudian psychiatry, psychoanalysis, comes from the sponsorship of Trotsky, of Leon Trotsky. Mm-hmm. And once his star begins to fade, the star of a Soviet Freudianism also begins to fade.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with it, that's another strand of Soviet sexology that you could put into this big grab bag of different players in the time period conducting various kinds of sexology. But it also shows a kind of direction of travel away from the psychological and away from what you could call the medicalization of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, I think, in terms of the psychiatrist in the courtroom. By the end of the 1920s, if it wasn't clear before, it's pretty clear by then that psychiatrists in the courtroom are meant to be delivering verdicts that are assisting the police and prosecutors to get a conviction. And in fact, if they produced any kind of evidence before a trial that didn't assist in securing a conviction, that evidence would probably have been edited out
mm-hmm.
before the brief was presented to a mm-hmm. court. I discussed the procedural business here. We're in a two-stage system of a preliminary investigation by police and court investigators, and then the trial itself. And things don't go to trial until the brief is pretty nicely tied up.
Yeah.
Preliminary investigation. And this is an old inheritance of Russian law that goes back to the middle of the 19th century, at least, in Alexander II's great reforms. But if you think about the gloomy atmosphere in a psychological atmosphere in Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, where where the protagonist doesn't know what's going to happen to him the trial, that's because he's in this strange preliminary investigation phase. And he keeps being called in for interviews to the...
You know, I just read that book. That explains so much. And then you find, last but not least, among all these cases, also hermaphrodites, which I found really interesting. So could you talk for one brief moment about the impact that the Bolshevik Revolution and all of these changes have on them and the way that physicians see them? I mean, one of the things that I found fascinating, I talked to Elizabeth Reese a couple of weeks ago about her body's endowed book about the history of hermaphrodites in the U.S. And one of the things that really struck me about your chapter is the fact that they are there in the first place. So tell us about hermaphrodites.
Well, no one's really written about them in Russian history. It's quite strange. And I got interested in this because it has been a big topic in history of sexuality and history of gender studies in the last 15 years or so. And this seemed an appropriate book, even though these people weren't sort of entering courts and being examined by forensic doctors. This seemed an appropriate place to discuss their challenge to the sexual order the Soviets were trying to build. And what was the sort of legal position? Up until 1926, Russia had no law about the hermaphrodite
whatsoever. Yeah.
So up until that point, Russian authorities, before the revolution and immediately after it, improvised whenever they ran into one. And normally they would detect hermaphrodites through various kinds of mass physical screenings. So the annual examination of young peasant males of a certain age who were to be recruited into the army, for example.
Okay.
That always grew up a handful of cases, and some of those got written up in the medical journals if they were sufficiently interesting. And that was a disqualifier for being recruited into the Tsarist army. The other major mass screening was actually the mass screening of prostitutes, licensed prostitutes. Prostitution was licensed in the Russian Empire from the 1840s until 1917, and there was a system of medical inspection. And that occasionally as well would throw up cases of hermaphrodites presenting as women and and offering their services. So those are two locuses where you might have expected some kind of systematic sort of view of the hermaphrodite, but there's really nothing codified. One of my important protagonists in the book, who is the leader of the forensic medical services for the entire Russian Federation in the early days of the Soviet regime, Yakov Leibovich, argues, he's a forensic gynecologist by training. He argues that the new regime needs some kind of systematic approach to this problem. It's a problem of passport sex, call it that.
Okay.
So that it's a problem for the authorities in terms of identifying whether this person fits under the male gender box or the female gender box.
Right.
And he argues, following German and other authorities from Western Europe, that the forensic medical expert should be the person who has the sort of final say about the prevailing sex in this person's body. And he actually persuades the Soviet regime and the identity tracking authorities, the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs, to enact an ordinance whereby the forensic medical expert can make that determination, and then the person's passport documents and other documents can be changed. That's enacted in 1926. So you have that kind of possibility where a person's passport sex can be changed, That's the situation that the Bolshevik Revolution brings. And I think mm-hmm. that the authorities are persuaded by that because it's scientific,
mm-hmm.
particularly bewildering problem that Marx hasn't anticipated, Engels doesn't have an answer for, even August Bebel couldn't think of what to do, I suppose. And there is a sense in which this is a clear case where medicine can provide an answer.
Yeah.
And has already had that ability to provide an answer in more advanced countries like Germany.
Yeah.
So that's the rationale behind that. And then, but in fact, tracking those passport changes of sex would be an enormous job for the historian to try and do, because it would mean trawling through local archives of the identity, the birth, death, and marriages record service,
yeah,
ZAGS in Russia, and looking for such changes, such very infrequent changes in passport sex. So that was not the route I chose to pursue. And instead, it was much easier to look for case histories of hermaphrodite mm-hmm. in the literature. And in fact, I was very fortunate. There's a poorly resourced but marvelous library in Moscow, a medical scientific library
mm-hmm.
in Moscow. And like most scientific libraries, they regard their older literature as kind of superfluous,
mm-hmm.
and they hide its catalogs away in a different section because it's ancient knowledge. It's not really useful knowledge anymore. But
yeah.
they did actually have a subdivision of their medical catalog for hermaphrodites for the pre-war period.
That's really interesting in itself.
It was marvelous. It was a small. Yeah. Catalog, and it was actually a catalog that listed where the articles were, and
yeah.
so we were able to call them up and assemble a database of something like 35 hermaphrodites
mm-hmm.
this 1920s to 1930s period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I made a study of the practices that are described in the articles of how the doctors understood their role, how the doctors tried to help, what sort of treatments they offered, what sort of treatments they found successful, unsuccessful, what approaches, and so on. So I was, again, trying to focus very much on practices and reading mm-hmm. those practices as some kind of indication of what they thought about the sexual revolution or how they interpreted the sexual revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So what did I find? First of all, I chose to screen out infants, hermaphrodites, and look at adults, because I really wanted to look at this problem of sexual psychology and the problem of sexual behavior and how mm-hmm. that's interpreted by the doctors. So that's a kind of a caveat to begin with. I found that the doctors were able to, first of all, discuss the sexual psychology of these patients really openly
mm-hmm.
in the medical literature in the 1920s and even into the 1930s, when other aspects of sexual psychology had been shut down
mm-hmm.
Completely. Freudianism thrown overboard after Trotsky is exiled, sexual revolutionary discourse associated with Alexander Kollontai and with the World League for Sexual Reform that the Soviets had been active in is also rejected after 1930-31. And so even into the 1930s, these doctors are able to publish discussions of sexual behavior and sexual response and sexual psychology among these special subjects because they are so special. And it seems to me that in part that's because of their physiological abnormality, and I mean
mm-hmm.
Inverted commas there, that their Abnormality is something that licenses a discussion of sexual response. Mm-hmm. And what I found as well was that the doctors were, by and large, open to the idea of changing the body to conform to a socially presented gender.
Mm-hmm.
So if they felt that it was that it would be successful, they were quite happy to make alterations, cosmetic alterations, mm-hmm. at that time, to the body in order that the person should present and perform successfully as a female or as a male.
And here, socially present means the gender that the person had adopted prior to this medical interaction, which is really interesting. So it's not that they came and said, oh, we suddenly you discover you're the other gender and you should change.
Many of these cases are self-referrals by hermaphrodites who are experiencing problems in their sexual life.
Interesting. Okay. So they actually are the ones who come and seek help.
That's right. That's right. So mm-hmm. they, again, represent a subset. There are more hermaphrodites out there, obviously, but they're suffering in silence.
Yeah.
Or they're perfectly happy with the way they are. They have some kind of modus vivendi. But these individuals, often, I think, because of social interactions or because of a failed marriage or a tottering marriage, want help, particularly help to perform sexually.
Yeah.
But also some of them are just confused about changes in their body and they know through comparison with people of the putative gender they live within that that they're different.
Yeah.
So I did establish that many of these subjects had actually referred themselves to doctors previously. That
mm-hmm.
the case history that I might have found in the library was the last in a line of encounters with medicine that mm-hmm. these individuals had had,
mm-hmm.
Or one of the few that had been written up. In other words. Mm-hmm. So it was, and almost in all of these cases, because they're published, there often is a discussion of the therapies that have been used, and those were usually some combination of surgery, cosmetic or corrective surgery, again, inverted commas, and sometimes the use of hormones, sex hormones, in a kind of experimental way to see if the polarity, the gender polarity of the body could be reversed
mm-hmm.
or cemented in a particular
mm-hmm.
direction.
So to kind of step back then, what would you say is the long-lasting impact of the Bolshevik sexual revolution?
Well, I think that what I was trying to discover, as I said at the beginning of this interview, in the book, was to try to find a different way to get at the sexual revolution that took during the 1920s. And I thought that was possible to do through looking at doctors and their practices. Because doctors are one part of this larger section of the Russian intelligentsia that wanted a sexual revolution, or at least many people within the radical and within the kind of the professional classes in Russia before the revolution said they wanted changes to the relations between the sexes. And so I wanted to see, I thought it would be possible to look at the sexual revolution through their activities in a very concrete way and compare and contrast that with what we think about the sexual revolution because we have this romanticized, maybe mm-hmm. way feminist view that comes from our 1960s and 70s rereading of Alexander Kollontai and Wilhelm, mm-hmm. that there is just a flourishing of anything goes in the Soviet Union at this time. And I think I've demonstrated in this book that the sexual revolution was not about anything goes.
Mm-hmm.
It was not the 1970s or the 1960s in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
Very different kind of sexual revolution, and one that was really very technocratic,
mm-hmm.
In a certain perspective, and also quite prescriptive, and had a very gendered sense,
mm-hmm.
how bodies should function, and about the place of the two genders in a two-sexed order and even in a socialist society of the future.
Mm-hmm.
So and one of the major conclusions I make is when people talk about the sexual revolution in Bolshevik Russia, they often talk about a kind of liberal 1920s when anything goes, and a more conservative 1930s when Stalin begins to close things down. And Stalinists begin to close things down, and a more conservative mm-hmm. gender order appears to obtain. And I am trying to say that, in fact, what's happening in the 1930s has a lot of continuity from the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
That doctors and experts are contributing to a conservative gender order that is being reconstructed,
mm-hmm.
even after the Civil War in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. So my last question is, you know, the kind of evolution. What is it that you're working on now? What has this led you to?
Well, working closely with medicine and law made me very conscious of that interface between doctors and police and prisons.
Yeah.
And, I am now working on a study of doctors in the Gulag, in Stalin's mm-hmm. camps.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've been working on that for a number of years now, and I've gathered quite a lot of material with the help of particularly Kirill Rossianov in the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking to publish a book one day on Gulag hospitals and medicine. So that's what I'm working on now.
I can't wait for that book and for another interview. And I have to thank you so much for being on this show.
Thank you very much.
We have been talking to Dan Healy, author of Bolshevik Sexual Forensics, Diagnosing Disorder in the Clinic and Courtroom 1917 to 1939, published by Northern Illinois University Press in 2009. I am Johanna Schön, co-host of New Books in Gender and Sexuality Studies. Please join us next time.